Salon at 615 presents best-selling authors free to the public through a unique partnership between Nashville Public Library, Humanities Tennessee, Parnassus Books, and the Nashville Public Library Foundation. This Salon at 615 was recorded live at the Nashville Public Library.
So, of course, I know that I'm in Music City, but I didn't realize until I got here what a literary town Nashville is. And so I'm really, really honored to have been invited. And thank you so much for coming tonight. Now, I, as was just mentioned, I was a high school English teacher for a lot of years. And so I know how to give a multiple choice quiz. So I have a multiple choice question for all of you. It's about the hat, all right? A, leave it on, B, take it off, or C, I don't give a crap, all right? How many of you think I should keep it on, take it off? Oh, tie. I don't give a crap. All right, library security, get these people out of here. Anyway, well, I'll take it off. I think that was probably the winner. Let my hair down. I wanted to give a shout out to somebody who's in the audience. I just met her this past weekend in Baton Rouge, and yet I feel like we are very good friends. And she is a local musician, and her name, I'm sure you know her, she is Mary Gaucher. Where are you, Mary? There she is over there, yeah. Thanks for coming tonight, Mary. Mary and I did a program at the Louisiana Book Festival. I was interviewing her at the festival in the Senate chamber for some odd reason in that city or in that state. Anyway, good to have you here. And I have to tell you that I am in the middle of a 40-city book tour, and a couple of days ago when I was in New Orleans. I sent my laundry out to the in the hotel laundry service, and they lost it. I'm glad to be here tonight because in two more days, either I'm going to have to be reunited with my laundry or go commando. I know that's TMI. If my wife were here, she would be saying, you know, the older you get, the fewer filters you have. Speaking of which, I did a little book tour shopping before I started. And I went into a store and I said to the clerk, I need new jeans. I need cooler jeans. I only have grandpa jeans. And the woman said, well, what kind of jeans are you looking for more specifically? I said, well, skinny jeans are popular, right? And, what's so funny? So she said, yeah. I said, okay, well, what I need are skinny jeans on the bottom and fat guy jeans up on the top. So she brought me to the maternity clothing place, and, they're very comfortable, actually. I wanted to tell you a little bit about We Are Water, and then I want to read from it. This is my fifth novel. It is a story about racism and family tragedy. It explores the evolution of American social mores and also how and why visual artists do what they do and if there is a connection between the creative process and madness. In some ways, this story is very different than its siblings, my earlier novels, I Know This Much Is True, and She's Come Undone, and The Hour I First Believed. For one thing, this one is told in eight different voices. Four of them are female, four of them are male. But although my approach was different this time, my goal was really pretty much the same as in the earlier stories. And that was to go in search of the, I guess I would say, the un-me, the other, and to explore not only the ways that we are all different from one another, but also what binds us together and makes us one. The ways in which I am you, and you are me, and we are all together, cuckoo, ka-choo. Yeah. A couple of Beatles fans in the audience there. We Are Water is rooted in two events that I recall from my childhood in my hometown in eastern Connecticut, the town of Norwich. In the 1950s, an unschooled African-American artist named Ellis Ruley lived and painted and married a white woman. First time that there had been an interracial marriage in that town. In his own lifetime, Ruley couldn't sell any of his paintings. And although the coroner ruled his death in 1959 to be accidental, Norwich's black community disputed that conclusion. And since his posthumous discovery in the 1980s, when his paintings thought to be destroyed suddenly began to resurface, today his works are prized by museums and collectors of American folk art. Now, in my novel, Ellis Ruley becomes the template for a fictitious character named Josephus Jones, who is a laborer who paints pictures because he can't not paint them. The other Norwich thread of this novel is a devastating flood that occurred in the city in March of 1963, the year I was 12 years old. A dam holding back a lake suddenly collapsed. It was an earthen dam. It was not supported. It was in the northern section of the city. It collapsed and unleashed 6 million gallons of icy water that rushed downhill and took a path of death and destruction, ruining much of the downtown area and taking 5 lives. And I vividly remember that night. I can still hear the roar of the water in my ears and the screams of the third shift factory workers who were buried alive in the rubble when the building where they were working collapsed. The raging water cut a path about 6 or 7 houses down from our family home. And of all the news stories that emerged in the days after the flood, it was the one about the Moody family that affected and still affects me the most. Let me tell you a little bit about them. Ron and Honey, her nickname was, Ron and Honey Moody were in their mid-20s, and they had 3 little boys. One was 4 years old. He was the oldest. They had a 2-year-old and an infant son as well, 3 boys. When news came very quickly and crazily that night that the dam had collapsed and the water was heading in a path that was going to strike the Moody's home. They lived in a downstairs apartment. They made a fateful decision. They decided that they were going to outrun the water. And so with the help of a 19-year-old neighbor upstairs, they got in their car and they gunned it down the hill. And then this wall of water came and hit them from the back. The car went into a tailspin, and then it went off a 15-foot retaining wall. As it has been described, the car goes underwater. They managed to get the doors open and get out of the car, and the 19-year-old neighbor and Ron Moody climbed into a tree, and Mrs. Moody was handing the 3 children up to her husband and the neighbor, whose name was Tony. Just when her husband got hold of her hand to pull her up into the tree as well, the water carried her away, and she was drowned. Her body was found weirdly floating in the basement floor of a funeral home nearby. But the 3 boys were rescued from the tree, as was Tony, and Ron Moody was in shock for that night. But he eventually recovered as well. So that happened in 1963. In 2009, I had just published a sort of a funny book, atypical for me, a comic novella called Wishin' and Hopin'. And I was at the local radio station promoting the book when the radio announcer said, just before the interview was closing, "So, what's next for Wally Lamb?" And I hate that question because I never know what's next, and I always fear that nothing is going to be next. And so rather than say, "Duh, you know, I don't know," I just picked something out of the air. And because I was in Norwich, I said, "Oh, I think I'm going to write about the flood." And, of course, if you lived in that town, you would know what flood I was talking about. Anyway, about 2 days later, I get a call from a woman named Nora Kasuba. I didn't know her. And she said, "I understand you're writing about the flood." And I lied a second time, and I said, "Yeah." And she said, "Well, you mentioned those three little boys in the tree. They're my cousins." And she said, "My cousin Tommy, the four-year-old, the oldest, is the only one who has any memory of his mother, and also he's the only one who has any memories of the flood night." And so she said, "Would you like to be connected with him?" And I said, "I certainly would." And that began a friendship and a working relationship that continued over the next 4 years. Tom Moody lives in the Dallas, Texas area, and he has been obsessed all his life with sort of fitting together the puzzle pieces of information about the tragedy. As is often the case, when tragedy strikes a family, they are reluctant to talk about it. And so there were a lot of missing pieces in Tom's understanding. He is an engineer, and so he was very interested in the sort of more technical aspects of the, you know, the dam and the, you know, the physics of it all. And so he started writing about it and published, self-published, a book, a nonfiction book called A Strange and Deadly Maelstrom, while I was writing a fictional version that starts off with that particular flood, but then goes off in other directions as well. Tomorrow, my book tour brings me to Dallas, Texas, and I'm going to have a reunion with Tom, and he's actually going to be at the bookstore and read a little bit of his book as well. Anyway, in constructing my novel, I used the Moody family story and the Ellis Ruley story, which really had nothing to do with each other, but here's where the fiction comes in. I set them apart almost like electrodes or poles, and they began to sort of electrify each other, and the electricity was bouncing off between the two of them and became my story. It is a story of an American family. The patriarch of that family is a guy named Orion O. That's O-H. He is half Italian and half Chinese. His father's Chinese, his mother is Italian. And I spent almost 3 years when I was writing this four-year project trying to figure out what that would look like. And looking all over the internet, you know, Google images and so forth, I could not find anybody who had the face of a half Italian and half Chinese guy. So I finally decided I would assign him a look. And some of you may remember an actor who was popular in the 70s and 80s. His name was James Ferrantino. And I decided that Orion O looks like James Ferrantino, so I could go on. Orion is married to Annie O. She, like Ellis Ruley, in actuality, is an untrained outsider artist who begins obsessively to make collages and installations from junk she finds on the sidewalk and in landfills and closeout sales and so forth, and she becomes quite successful. Orion is a psychologist who works with students at a university, and they are married for 27 years. They have three adult children, all in their 20s. And when Annie moves to New York part-time so that she can pursue her art and the commerce of art in New York City, she falls in love with a woman named Vivica, and she leaves Orion for this woman. And because Connecticut has just legalized gay marriage, she and Vivica are going to be married in Connecticut rather than in New York. This is Orion O. Looking back, I'm amazed at how much in denial I was about her and Vivica. Yeah, I'd get worried from time to time, but what I thought was maybe she'd gotten involved with some other guy. I would imagine him, worry about him even, sometimes picture her walking hand in hand with him, some artist or musician type, or some lanky younger guy with a pork pie hat and a couple of days' worth of stubble. But the only time I confronted her about another man, she got huffy. She said that it was all about her work and that my insecurity was my problem, not hers. And hey, whenever I called her, she was almost always there where she was supposed to be, either at her studio or at night at Vivica's apartment. Once when I called and Vivica answered, she said, "You know, Oren, one of these days you and I'll have to meet in person." And I let it go that she had gotten my name wrong and that we had already met several years before at the biennial opening. Yeah, I'd like that too, I said. I went down to visit Annie at the apartment two or three times, but each time it was when Vivica was out of town for the weekend. I still don't know when they made the switch from roommates to lovers. Annie has told me that it happened over time, that their affair was not premeditated. And I believe her, but it's interesting, you know, the way she had put it, premeditated, as if it was a crime, which it was in a way. It was the murder of our marriage. Sometimes we want something to be true so badly that we convince ourselves that it is true. I mean, how many times have I suggested that to one of the undergraduates sitting across from me in my office? Some self-deluding young woman who was trying to convince herself that a boyfriend's having smacked her around was a one-time thing, or some young guy's assertion that although sex with other guys excited him, he wasn't really gay. "Put your hand out," I would tell these students. "Now bring it closer. Now bring it closer still." And when their hands were a half an inch from their noses, I would ask them to describe what they saw. "It's a blur," they would say. And I'd suggest that sometimes the closer we got to a situation, the less clear it looked, and that when wishful thinking trumped the reality, we might otherwise be able to see more clearly and manage. We were setting ourselves up for a rude awakening. Well, psychologist, heal thyself. Little by little, I began to withdraw my own hand from my face, as it were, began to face the fact that Annie and I no longer were together, that she had defected. The showdown came one Sunday afternoon when, in the middle of an argument we were having about her absenteeism, I said, "Do you even want to be married to me anymore?" We were in our kitchen. I was at the stove making dinner. Annie was at the table going through 2 weeks' worth of accumulated mail. "Of course I do," I wanted to hear her say. But what she said instead was that she wasn't sure anymore, that she was confused. "Confused?" I picked up the frying pan and slammed it back down against the burner. The noise made her jump. "Well, if you're confused, how the hell do you think I feel?" At this stage of our crumbling marriage, our battle roles had reversed themselves. Annie had always been the one who yelled and banged things when we argued. I was always the one who spoke softly and civilly, maintaining the upper hand. Now, I was the shouter, the slammer. She opened her mouth to say something, and then she stopped herself, stood and walked out of the room, out of our house, and down the road. I stood at the window, watching her go. That was my rude awakening. So when I started this novel, I wanted the perspective of both the husband and the wife, and so I began to write tandem chapters. I would give Orion his chance to talk, and then I would give Annie her chance, and it went back and forth and back and forth. Here is Annie talking about the dissolution of their marriage. The truth, whether Orion believes it or not, is that I hadn't left him for Vivica. I had left him for New York, for the opportunities it offered me creatively and commercially. What developed between Vivica and me had been unplanned. My defection, Orion had called it on that awful Sunday back in Connecticut, when I finally admitted that Vivica and I had become involved, that I had fallen in love with her. I was a Judas, he said. I could get my own goddamn ride back to the train station because he sure as hell was not going to take me there. He was through with being a fucking sap, he said. I had had to hire a cab to New Haven, and on the train ride back to the city, I kept replaying our argument. If I was Judas, then that made him Jesus Christ, right? Well, maybe he should come down from his cross and take some responsibility for the fact that our marriage had failed. Which of us had practically raised Andrew and the girls single-handedly all those years when he would leave for work early and come back home late, sit in his office all day and into the evening counseling college kids about their problems? But what about my problems? What about the fact that I felt frustrated and neglected all those years while he was playing savior to those troubled students of his, and then coming home and feeling sorry for himself because of the toll they took, drinking his beers and falling asleep by 9 when I still had laundry to fold and put away and 3 school lunches to make for the next morning before I could go down to my gloomy little studio and grab a measly hour or two for my work. Well, thank goodness the bitterness has subsided on both of our parts. We have our kids to thank for that and our mutual investment in their lives, our shared worries about their unhappiness and their safety, our daughter Ariane's failed romances, our worries about where Andrew's military career might take him, and where Marissa's impetuousness might take her. Our concern for our kids, their well-being, binds us despite our divorce, and will always bind us. And Orion's come around. He's made an effort with Vivica, despite the fact that I can tell he doesn't like her. Whether Vivica understands it or not, I still care about Orion, which is why I'm worried about him. Why, maybe I shouldn't have put his name on the guest list, made the decision myself instead of listening to Marissa's, "Daddy is an adult, Mom. He can decide if he wants to go or not." Because the last thing I want to do is make him feel that he has to come if it'll be too weird or too painful. So I was going back and forth with this ex-husband and ex-wife, and they were referring quite often to their kids, the twins, Ariane and Andrew, and their younger sister, Marissa. And then one day, it was unplanned. I never know where I'm going with the story until I get there. I let the kids start talking. In this scene, we hear from Andrew on the subject of whether or not he should go to his mother's wedding. Andrew has always been a button pusher with his mother. He has always kind of aggravated her, and she very often would snap, not at his sisters, but always at her male child. And sometimes that anger would bubble to the surface, and she would become physically abusive with Andrew. Now, the other kids would observe this, but they kept a secret from their father. He didn't know that these outbursts were happening. Anyway, Andrew enters the military. He gets stationed at Fort Hood down in Texas, and he starts dating an evangelical Christian young woman She's a kindergarten teacher. And he becomes born again himself. There is a third person in this scene, and if you listen to the radio, you might recognize her. I tidied up my point of view. I got a new attitude. I'm Dr. Laura Schlesinger, and I do welcome you to this hour of the program. Our number here is 1-800-DR-LAURA. That's 1-800-DR-LAURA. I'm here with Kimberly Neal, who screens your calls, Benjamin Pratt, who orchestrates our music, and me. I am my kid's mom, ready to preach, teach, and nag you into doing the right thing. Casey Lee, welcome to the program. Oh, hi, Dr. Laura. Thank you for taking my call. Thank you. I've been listening to you since my mom used to pick me up from grade school, and I just wanted to say what an honor it is to speak with you. Thank you. How can I help? I'm sorry, I'm a little nervous. It's okay. Do you want me to give you some background, or should I get right to my question? Well, just start. We'll see where it goes. Okay. Well, actually, I'm calling for my fiancé. He's got a family situation that he's struggling with, and so I suggested we call Dr. Laura and see what she has to say about it. And your fiancé's name is Andrew. His problem, well, see, his parents are divorced, okay, and his mother is getting remarried to a woman. Uh-huh. And your question for me is, well, whether we should go to their wedding or not. You see, he grew up in a family that wasn't very religious, but since we've been going out, he's found his Lord and Savior. We already said we couldn't go, but now he's getting pressure from one of his sisters about how we should, because it'll hurt their mother if we don't. And yesterday, his mom's partner sent us plane tickets so that we can surprise her. And, well, the thing is, I mean, don't you think gay marriage is sinful? Well, what I think is beside the point. What do you think? Me? Yes? Okay. Now, a minute ago, you said this was your fiancé's problem, so why is it that you're calling me instead of him? Oh, well, because I said I would. He's right here, though. Ah, well, put him on. Oh, okay. She wants to talk to you. No, I don't want to. No, come on, come on. Hello? Hi, Andrew. Hey, how are you? I'm fine, thank you. Now, first of all, I have a note from Kimberly that says you're a member of the military. Is that right? Yes, ma'am. United States Army, Specialist E-4. Ah, what's your specialty, soldier? Well, I'm in a nurse's training program. Well, thank you for your service to your country, and hoo-yah. Yes, ma'am. Thank you, ma'am. Casey Lynn says that you're conflicted about going to your mother's wedding. Why don't you tell me about that? Okay, well, like Casey said, she's getting married to a woman, okay, and she's... Well, my mother is an artist, kind of a free spirit, you know? And her and this woman have been living together for a while, and now they're going to get married, which, you know, they can do legally because the wedding is going to be in Connecticut. And so part of me thinks I should go because, you know, she's my mom. And what's the other part telling you? What? Well, you just told me that part of you is telling you to go, so I'm assuming there's another part that's telling you not to, right? Yes, ma'am. Because I don't, well, me and Casey don't, oh, we feel that marriage should be between a man and a woman, whether, you know, it's legal or not. So this wedding flies in the face of your values then. Well, yes, ma'am. Plus, I don't know, I just think that going would be disloyal to my dad. I mean, him and my mom are divorced, but divorced for how long? Over a year now, but they've been separated for like 3 years. And how long had they been married? My mom and dad, maybe 26, 27 years, and they decided to end their marriage because of her, I guess, this woman she's marrying. See, she started working in New York, okay, because of her art, and she was renting a room in this woman's fancy apartment, okay? So then one thing led to another, and then what? Your mother decided she likes women better than men? Fancy apartments? New York deli? Well, I think it was about living in New York at first because, you know, the art scene. She does these crazy experimental installations, she calls them. Not the kind of art you would hang over your sofa then. Okay, got it. Have you discussed your conflict with your father? Yeah, and you know, he's pretty cool about it, actually. At least he says he is. He may even go to the wedding. Really? Wow. I'm not sure if that makes him the most forgiving man in the universe or the most masochistic. Well, the thing is, I don't even think she's really homosexual. I just think, Andrew, you need to face the facts, babe. You told me that your mother left your father for a lesbian hookup. Well, that makes her a lesbian, and now she wants to make it legal so that she and her shack-up honey can, well, I don't know if I would put it that way. No, of course you wouldn't. Honor thy mother, right? But did your mother honor her solemn covenant that she made with your father? No, she didn't. Doesn't really matter what this other person's gender is. What matters is that she forsook her vow to love, honor, and cherish her husband, to be faithful to him. You got it? Well, yeah, I guess. Then for whatever reason, your father doesn't want to man up and say, screw you, babe, if you think I'm going to your big gay wedding. I see no reason why that obligates you to. Well, you see, my dad is a peacemaker. Plus, one of my sisters keeps bugging me to, Andrew, you and your girl called me for advice, so why don't you stop talking over me and listen to what I have to say? Oh, okay, I'm sorry. It doesn't matter what your father's decision is or what this silly sister of yours wants you to do. If your values are telling you that this marriage is wrong, then going to the wedding would say otherwise. So you're saying I shouldn't go? No, I'm saying that if you decide to go, your presence makes a statement. And if you decide not to go, that makes a different statement. It's up to you to decide which statement you want to make. So we've got Andrew struggling. Oh, thank you. We've got Andrew struggling down there in Texas, and his twin sister, Ariane, who has always been the family peacekeeper, the family people pleaser. She worked very hard in high school. She was very highly motivated, always trying to do good for other people. And that carries into her adult life. She is a soup kitchen manager out in San Francisco. She is flying back from California to Connecticut to attend her mother's wedding. And she is thinking about a big decision she has made and has not told anybody yet. I think Mama and Daddy will be okay with my decision once I tell them. Get that part over with. I'm pretty sure Daddy won't have a problem with it. He didn't know his father, but he turned out fine. And yes, I'll explain to them if I have to. I am younger than most of the women who get pregnant this way. And maybe the right guy could still come along, but I don't want to keep playing the wait and hope game until I'm 40. What if my eggs are too old by then? The chances for birth defects are a lot greater for older moms. And yes, there's always adoption if you want to gamble on the genetic cocktail of two strangers. At least this way, I was able to read the donors' histories, weed out some of the potential for problems. It's not foolproof, I know that. And they pay these guys to do what they do, about $100, I've heard. So I guess they could lie on their forms if they needed the money. Well, I'm going to love this child no matter what he or she turns out to be. The flight attendant comes by with her plastic bag and we deposit our refuse. The ginger ale must have worked, I guess, because my stomach feels more settled. I give up on home from the hospital, and when I slip the book back into my bag, I see the red folder in there. Take it out. I'm not sure why I brought it with me, or for that matter, why I didn't shred what's in it once I made my decision. It's innocuous looking, though. As long as I hold it close to myself, neither of my seatmates will be able to read what's in there, the photocopied fact sheets of my prospective donors. For the millionth time, I look over the forms of the two that I narrowed it down to. Should I have picked number 251 instead of 311? Brown hair and eyes, 5'9", no history of cancer in his family, college educated, no alcohol or drug issues other than recreational use of marijuana occasional. He was the one I thought I was going with. And then at the last minute, I picked number 311 instead. Brazilian ethnicity, 1.5 years of college instead of 4. A mother who died at age 46. The reason listed is not cancer or heart disease. Boating accident, it says. I look at the math I did in the margin of his fact sheet. He was 13 when he lost her. Why did I change my mind? Was it because I felt sorry for him, this motherless boy who is now almost 30? Well, whatever the reason, it's a done deal. Number 311 has fathered the life that's growing inside of me, this child that I already love, who will give me a purpose besides feeding the poor, and who will love me no matter how much I weigh. I'm going to read one more voice. It's just a short short listen to a guy named Kent Kelly, who doesn't show up till quite late in the novel, but has had an enormous effect on Annie O's life and her art, and the fact that she has kept some rather toxic secrets. So this is Kent Kelly. Predator? Pedophile? Child molester? Yeah, you could call me any of those things, but don't forget victim, too, because that was what came first. You think I was born this way? I wasn't. I got fucked up, emotionally dysregulated, as the shrinks put it, the year that I was 9. This one therapist in training who interviewed me last month, a grad student gathering data for some study she was doing about how pedophilia gets kick-started in childhood. She was quizzing me for a couple of hours about how I became who I became. "Please be as candid and as thorough as you can," she said. Well, I told her some of it, the abridged version, let's say. I mean, you can never fully trust shrinks, no matter how sincere they seem. So you withhold. You bullshit them. Manipulate them a little for your own amusement. But those questions she kept lobbing at me brought it all back so vividly that it was like I was reliving it. You see, the trouble started after my father left my mother and me so that he could shack up with his girlfriend and her son, puny little Peter Clegg, who was in my class at school. It was confusing, you know? My dad was a mailman, and Peter's mother was the postmaster's secretary, and that was how their little romance got started. But at the time, I didn't get any of that. I just assumed that he had left me because he liked Peter better than he liked me. What I couldn't figure out was why. Anyway, Dad left us high and dry. I was in Cub Scouts, okay? One week, Mom was a housewife and our den mother, and the next week she was a grocery clerk down at the First National. And that was when I had to start taking the bus over to this woman Irma's house after school. Irma Cake. She was a foster mother, but she babysat other kids too. Us after-school kids had to play down in the basement so that we wouldn't wake the babies up from their naps or bother her while she was watching her stories on TV. Those babies all must have been heavy sleepers, I guess, because she'd have that volume up so loud that you could hear the television through the floorboards. Time now for The Edge of Night. We were only allowed upstairs at snack time, or if we had to use the toilet. And if you needed to tell Irma something while you were up there, you had to wait for a commercial. Irma's daughter, Tawny, she was in charge downstairs. And to this day, I fantasize about running into Tawny Cake on the street somewhere and making her pay for the things that she did. One time, when I was in prison, I woke up smiling from a dream where I had just plunged a shiv into her heart. Sorry. Anyway, so that's a little taste of the different voices that from their own dimensions tell the story. Now, I am happy to take some questions if you have them, and some comments if you are curious about certain things. And there you all are. Yeah, nice. I'll start out by telling you. I know it's always hard to be the first person to raise your hand. But I have to start by telling you that one time I was declared the royal reader for a kindergarten class, and I wasn't reading any of my books, believe me. But I was. It was a hot day. It was almost summertime, and the kids and I were out on the playground. We were all running around, having a great old time. And then it was time for, as the royal reader, for me to go in and sit on my my throne, as it were, with my crown on my head, and read them a story. And the kids all sat cross-legged on the floor in front of me, and they had name tags. And they were laughing at all the right places. I was enjoying them. They were enjoying the story. And so with this burst of confidence, I said to them, "Now, before I turn the page, does anybody have any questions?" And this little girl raises her hand, and I looked, I squinted, and I read her name tag. And I said, "Yes, Fanny, what's your question?" And she said, "Why are there two big wet marks under your arms?" A while back, I had the honor of meeting Neil Armstrong, the first man to walk on the moon, and I was telling him that story. We were talking about speaking to children, and he said, "Oh, I have one of those stories." He said, "I was giving a talk about astronomy to a mixed group of adults and kids, and he said there was one kid who sat in the front, and you know, he was like this. He was very intent on everything I had to say, and so when he asked during the Q&A if anybody had any questions, this kid shot his hand up and he said, "Yes, young man, what's your question?" And the kid said, "You want to see me do a somersault?" So, keeping in mind that Neil Armstrong answered that question and I answered the question that I had, yes.
You wait till, at the very end of the book to talk about water and, of course, the name of the book. At what point did you name the book We Are Water?
Yeah, that's a good question. And, you know, with my first three novels, I had the story and I didn't know what to call it. She's Come Undone. Was an old song. Some of you are of a certain age might remember a Canadian group called the Guess Who. Well, it took me about 9 years to write She's Come Undone, and I still didn't have a satisfactory title. And then one day I'm driving to school, of course high school starts pretty early, so I'm barreling down the hill, nervously hitting the buttons on the radio because I was a little late. And all of a sudden, that song "She's Come Undone" came on the radio, and I got so excited that when it hit me like lightning, I almost went off the side of the road. And so I go running into my home room. Well, you know, teenagers at 7:15 in the morning, they're all like this, And so I said, "Hey, kids, what do you think of this for a novel title? She's Come Undone." And they're like, "Yeah, Mr. Lim, whatever. Yeah, it's great. Yeah." So that's sort of, those first novels, I didn't know what to call them until I finished them. But The Hour I First Believed and this one, We Are Water, the title came before I knew the story or the characters or anything like that. And for that, I would have to go back to 2007. Some of you may know a singer-songwriter named Patty Griffin. I'm a big Patty Griffin fan. I've got all of her CDs. And so when I heard that the Atlantic Theater Company in New York, I live in Connecticut, so New York is about 2.5 hours away, and I heard that the Atlantic Theater Company was doing a little off-Broadway musical based on Patty Griffin songs. And so I wanted to go see it. So my wife and I drive down, and in the middle of this little musical, which, by the way, starred a then-unknown actor-singer named Matthew Morrison, who later became famous on television's Glee. He's the music teacher on Glee. Anyway, he was the male lead in this thing. And one of the songs was "We Are Water." Well, I didn't know that Patty Griffin song, but I remember writing it down on the playbill and saying, "We are water. We are water. What does that mean?" And I like the alliterative, sort of sound of it. And then 2 years later, I'm doing that radio show, and I have to make up an answer and said, "I'm going to write about the flood." So it was that title, and then 2 years later, that answer that sort of collided with each other, and that's how that happened. Each one of my five novels and the two anthologies that I've done with my prison students, they all have connections to song. The Hour I First Believed is a phrase in the middle of Amazing Grace. So, you know, that's my sort of a little good luck thing. I always relate it to song in some way. Yes, ma'am.
I'm glad you mentioned your work with the inmates.
Uh-huh.
I hope you'll forgive me if I don't comment on your new book because I haven't read it yet.
Oh, I hope I didn't give you any spoilers.
No, me neither. But what what really has endeared you to me ever since I read your book, Can't Keep It to Myself, is your work with incarcerated women, because I stumbled into a program back in 1990 thinking I was going to be a mentor at the Tennessee Prison for Women for 8 weeks, mm-hmm. and 23 years later, I'm still doing it, and I just wanted to thank you so much for your work with the women and for helping them write their stories. It's so important that they hear their own voices.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. No. Well, my story is similar to yours because in 1998, I was just finishing a teaching assignment at the University of Connecticut. And I was packing up my office. I had the key in my hand to hand back to the office secretary or the department secretary, and the phone rang, and the person on the other end of the line was a woman named Margie Cohen, who I had played dodgeball in the street with when I was a kid. And she said, Wally, you know, she's the librarian, or she was the librarian at York Prison. And she said, we're in trouble here. She said, the governor of Connecticut had just been elected, a guy named John Rowland, and he had been elected partly on a platform where he was going to get tough on crime. And when he was the governor, the prisons in Connecticut were not going to be club meds, which they hardly were anyway. But anyway, he, good for his word, he started cutting back on psychiatric services. And he paramilitarized the guards. He put male guards there. Prior to that, they had been all women who were the guards. And, you know, they had dogs sniffing and so forth. And the women were having bad reactions because many of them, the majority, suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder. Anyway, there had been 2 suicides. And there had been, I think, 3 more attempts. And Margie was calling to ask that, you know, the teachers at the prison school were trying to brainstorm and get anybody they could to come and talk about their work and just to sort of distract the women. So I reluctantly said I would, and then I avoided doing it for almost the whole summer. And then in August, I finally made good on my promise. I went down there, and this was a voluntary kind of thing. So I think about 40 women had signed up for this program. I was just going to talk about my writing, you know, for 90 minutes, and then I was going to get the hell out of there. The women, I found out, were not so interested in my writing, but they were interested in the fact that I had been on the Oprah book, you know, the Oprah show, and with the book club things. And so I spoke about the writing, and then I asked if anybody had any questions about writing, and these were their questions about writing. You met Oprah? You know, Oprah's cool, you know what I'm saying? You know. And so so I was packing up my stuff, and there was one woman whose nickname was Manhattan, and she was the scariest woman in the whole 40 of them. And she sat there the whole time. I would walk back and forth in front of the class, and, you know, she would eye me as if, you know, she was going to get me. And so I was very surprised when she raised her hand at the end, and I said, yes. And she said, thanks for coming. And I said, oh, you're welcome. And she said, are you coming back? And because I'm such a chicken, and I thought she might kill me if I said no, I said yes. I said, all right, I'll come back in 2 weeks. I tell you what, you write something, anything, you know, 2 pages. I don't care what, you know, what you want to write. And, you know, that'll be your ticket back in. We'll have a workshop. Well, we went from 40 women the first time to about 12 the second time because they actually had to do something. But those 12 women, You know, their first drafts were as bad as my first drafts, and yet they cared about it. And then they wanted me to come back again. And so that was 14 years ago. And like you, I go back because not because I'm such a great guy, but because I'm getting something back. I've been a teacher all my adult life. I've never worked with such appreciative students. They're so happy to see me when I go. They work hard. They have turned into wonderful critics and supporters of one another. Their feedback is a professional quality because unlike, you know, working with students for a semester or a year, I've worked with many of them for years and years, a decade and a half in some cases. And so you get to see this enormous growth. And it's just been wonderful. You know, I don't mean to present myself as a therapist, but I am witness to the therapeutic value of their taking these horrible secrets out of themselves and putting it on paper and then doing this really brave thing, sharing it with other people and with me. You know, why should they trust this, you know, bald, middle-aged, late middle-aged white guy, you know? But they do. And then little by little they begin to take control of their lives. They're not so bowed down with guilt about the things that they did, and they, you know, they get stronger. Now, the problem back in 2003, when their work became good enough to be published, was that it was going to be published in this anthology. When I found that that was a possibility, I went to the prison authorities and I told them about this. I said, you know, please, you know, if you have security problems, let me know. Here's the manuscript. Please work with me. And they never took me up on that. They never called back the HarperCollins lawyers when they wanted to get a hold of them. And the women from the book sale were each going to have somewhere between $5,000 and $6,000 that was going to be waiting for them after they served their sentences so they could, you know, restart their lives. But the state of Connecticut pulled a surprise attack, and they sued the women, not me, but they sued the contributors, not for their, you know, $5,500, but for the entire cost of their incarceration. They billed them $117 a day times the number of days in their sentence. So a woman named Bonnie Forshaw, who has been in prison since 1986, and had at the time about $3 in her commissary account to buy overpriced toilet paper, she suddenly owed the state of Connecticut $917,000. I mean, it was cruel, it was ridiculous. Like I said, I'm a chicken, but I just couldn't let this happen, and so I fought back. I nominated one of the women for the First Amendment Award that's given out by the Penn American Center, and is funded by Paul Newman's company, Newman's Own. He was alive back then. And so you had to write up a statement about why, you know, this woman's freedom of speech was under attack. Well, she won the award, and with that award came $25,000. And so that's when, excuse my vulgar language, but that's when the shit really hit the fan, I tell you. They told me I was no longer welcome at the prison. They confiscated the women's floppy disks. I mean, they still, there's no internet at the prison, but they, you know, there are these old rickety computers, and we still use those. Remember when floppy disks really were floppy? Yeah, that's what we use. They confiscated the women's disks, and then they deleted all of the writing from the hard drives. 5 years of their hard-earned writing, they just deleted them, wiped it out. Well, I called the Penn American Center and told them what they were doing. The Penn American Center called 60 Minutes, and 60 Minutes called the prison to ask about this, and the prison made its fateful error. They lied to 60 Minutes and said, no, I was making all this up. It didn't happen. Well, I had the proof. I had the memo. They were fabricating it all. So when you lie to 60 Minutes, it's like throwing red meat to hungry dogs. And so all of a sudden, The state of Connecticut does a backflip, and this was a wonderful program. And we are going to, we're going to settle this lawsuit because Wally is doing such a great job, and we believe in rehabilitation. Blah blah blah, and so it all got settled. Here's how it got settled: the women could now keep their $5,500, except for $500 that they had to donate to the writing program. You know, that would be the writing program that they tried to kill. Shortly after that, John Rowland, the governor of Connecticut, went into prison. Barbara Parsons, the winner of the First Amendment Award, leaves prison. The commissioner of corrections is being sued by his female staff for sexual harassment issues. So he quits unceremoniously, and he goes over to, he becomes an administrator at Abu Ghraib prison. And then about 6 months later, that whole thing blows up. I mean, I'm a fiction writer. I could not make this stuff up. You know? So it all turned out okay, and you know, and I'm still going down there. Now they're so nice to me, I think they're afraid 60 Minutes is coming back. So anyway. who else has a question or a comment? Anybody? Yes, ma'am. Oh, wait for the mic now.
I know this much is true, right after college, and I was a teacher. We had a daughter. We lost an infant daughter, and then 3 years ago, we had twins. So,
oh, my gosh.
Yes.
And both of those are in the plot of I Know This Much Is True.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. And so I've felt a great connection to your work ever since, and a lot of comfort in it. And my question is, we also just got a dog, and I named him Wally.
Whoa! I'll drink to that.
I didn't even let my kids give input. The dog's name is Wally. So my question is, why twins? There's twins in We Are Water. And there's twins and
yeah, you've read my stuff, huh?
Definitely.
It's not any great intellectual thing, but when I was a kid, I grew up with older sisters and older girl cousins who lived right next door. Bossy, you know, four bossy girls in a predominantly girl-centric neighborhood, and the only other boy to play with on McKinley Avenue was Vito Signorino, and he used to throw rocks at me, or in the wintertime, snowballs. And on one memorable afternoon, walking home from school, he threw a rock inside of a snowball at me. It hit me, and my mother told me I couldn't play with Vito anymore. Well, I didn't want to play with Vito, you know. It was not a problem for me. But so when I was a kid, I was sort of very often cast in the role of the observer, right? And so. I wasn't a particularly lonely kid, but I was a solitary kid. And I used to amuse myself by making up stories. I didn't write them down. I drew them. And so I would make comic book stories. We had twins in our school, and two or three sets of twins. And I was always envious of the twins because it struck me as something very cool to have your built-in soulmate there. Every year on my birthday, I would stand in front of my birthday cake and wish for a brother. Never happened. But then I grow up and I have three sons, and I just delight in the brotherhood that they have. But twins keep coming up over and over because I'm always just fascinated with the relationship between twins and some of the challenges that twins have. And also, I think I'm still a little bit envious of twins. Are yours fraternal or are identical?
Girl and boy.
Oh, okay. I actually think that fraternal twins probably have an easier road in life than identicals because they can be their own selves as opposed to being half of something. But that's, you know, I'm not an expert. One more question? Okay. Anybody?
Oh, here.
Yes, ma'am.
You mentioned that it took 9 years to write one of your novels. Was that your first one?
Yes, and I was writing part-time because I was teaching high school. So I would write on weekends. I would drive up to the Yukon Library. They had an all-night study room. And I'm an early riser, so that was not a particular problem, but I would get up at 4 or 5 in the morning, and I was writing in longhand, so I'd have all these big folders and my Bic pens, and I would, on the way there, I would stop at the open all-night convenience store and get this size coffee and come out of my dream state and start writing. It was, the all-night study room was pretty empty except for, a couple of students asleep snoring into their calculus notes and me. And then I would go home about 8 o'clock, 8:30, and be dad and, mow the lawn and, rake the leaves and all that stuff. And then I would write during the summer. I would write full-time. I'd have business hours. But still, that novel took me about 9 years to write. And then I Know This Much Is True took 6 years. And then my third novel took 9 years, The Hour I First Believed.
Wow.
And at that point, I was writing full-time, pretty much. But I had to get over my success. I had had two picks from the Oprah Book Club, two very exciting wild rides with all that. And then all of a sudden, the ride ended, and I had to write a new book. And my agent at the time had dollar signs in her eyes, and so she got me this unbelievably lucrative contract that scared me to death. And I didn't think I could write a book that was going to be worth that much money. And I spun my wheels. I was just, I was in despair about it. I seriously considered giving back the advance money and, going back to teaching and, ending it. But not ending it, like, not that. But then in the middle of this sort of fear and despair, I mean, I was really scared. And I sort of felt like I had been they made a mistake or something. And so in the midst of this, I had said I would do a teaching thing at the Tennessee Williams Festival in New Orleans. And so I went down in this kind of state of despair, and I taught my class, but other than that, I didn't take part in any of the activities. And I remember walking around in that city that I had never been to before, and I came upon, in Jackson Square in the French Quarter, I came upon the St. Louis Cathedral. And I walked in there, and the church was empty, and I walked up to the front, and I lit a candle, and I knelt, and I said, I remember the prayer that I said, whoever or whatever you are, I mean, for all I knew, I could have been praying to the ghost of Tennessee Williams, I said, I'm really scared, could you please help me to find a story? And, I went home, and within that week, I started The Hour I First Believed. Subsequently, my son Jared graduated from college and went into the Teach for America program. And where was he posted? New Orleans. Then Katrina happened, and he had to evacuate. But he went back to the city, stayed in teaching, and then his younger brother Justin went into Teach for America, and he was also posted in New Orleans. And so this place that was a place of despair for me has turned into, almost like a second home. And I just visited my guys there with my wife, and every time I go there, I separate from the group, and I go back to the St. Louis Cathedral to say thank you for allowing me to tell that story, even though it was a 9-year, hard road. But I guess I'll end with that story, and thank you very much. I'm happy to sign books.